Hello, and thanks for joining us on Chicago Tonight, Black Voices. I'm Brandis Friedman. Here's what we're looking at. Shoplifting, calling 911 too many times, or just being the victim of a crime could get you evicted from your home in parts of Illinois. A new investigation shows how. Local author Lovey Ajayi Jones is encouraging kids to speak up and make positive change in her new children's book.
It showed them that they can trust me and come to me with their hair.
And a West Side teen is going viral for her school bathroom makeovers. And now to some of today's top stories. Parents, students, teachers, and neighbors will get the chance to tell the Chicago Board of Education who they think should be the next CEO of Chicago Public Schools. The board is announcing 10 citywide meetings to help choose the district's next leader, the first to be chosen by the hybrid elected and appointed board. The board says it'll host one meeting in each of the city's 10 elected school board districts and has enlisted an executive search firm to create a report from those meetings. Outgoing CEO Pedro Martinez is set to leave in June after being terminated by the then mayoral appointed board late last year. And fiery comments at today's CTA board meeting as Alderman David Moore warned directors not to be a, quote, backbiting snake, and to support Mayor Johnson's reported pick for the transit agency's next leader. Moore's comment came after widespread pushback to the mayor's reported choice of city chief operating officer John Roberson for the job, which was first reported by Cranes. Among other jobs in city government, Roberson once served as Moore's chief of staff. At the meeting, three board members publicly spoke out in favor of a national search to find a successor to former President Dorval Carter, who retired earlier this year. Moore claimed that launching a national search amounts to moving the goalposts during the game. Some directors pushed back on his comments, calling them inappropriate and insulting. The board must approve or deny the mayor's choice of CTA leader. Immigrant families in Illinois facing uncertainty under the Trump administration now have a new resource. A coalition of immigration groups, along with the city and state, are launching a new website aimed at connecting immigrants with information and resources. The website is illinoisimmigrationinfo.org and is available in multiple languages. Organizers say the website will share information on policy changes, access to free and low-cost legal services, guidance on constitutional rights, and additional resources on housing, discrimination, and public benefits. A news release says the website was made possible through philanthropic support. Patients living with HIV can find services and treatment at a new facility in the Edgewater neighborhood. Vivant Health plus TPAN has been open just 6 months, but says patients are already showing improvements.
People have engaged in care for the first time. They've become virally suppressed after struggling with chronic non-adherence. They've accessed PrEP or helped a partner access PrEP, and they've made strides on controlling their chronic medical conditions that they didn't even think was possible before they engaged in care with us.
Officials cut the ribbon on the almost 21,000 square foot facility, which will house a pharmacy, behavioral health facilities, and a food pantry to provide wraparound services. In Chicago, 85% of Vivant Health patients have no insurance or rely on Medicaid or Medicare, and 43% live below the federal poverty line. Vivant says of the nearly 19,000 people in the city and county with HIV, 25% are not engaged in care. And Chicago drivers, beware of new speed cameras across the city. You'll only be issued a warning, not a fine. That is only for the first 30 days after each new camera is activated. But after that period is over, there will be some financial consequences. Drivers going 6 to 10 miles per hour over the speed limit will be fined $35, and those going faster than that will be fined $100. Cameras in these locations began issuing warnings on May 1st and will start giving citations June 15th. And then these spots will begin warnings tomorrow with tickets starting June 30th. The city says more speed cameras will be added throughout the year. Up next, a deep dive into so-called crime-free housing laws right after this.
Chicago Tonight, Black Voices, is made possible in part by the support of these donors.
Thank you. A new investigation is revealing how in some Illinois cities, a simple 911 call can get some renters evicted from their homes. The local ordinances that allow this, known as crime-free housing laws, were designed to allow police and landlords to evict violent criminals, drug dealers, and nuisance tenants from neighborhoods. But reporting shows some residents were evicted for minor infractions or sometimes for crimes they didn't commit. Joining us now with more is Sydney King Pineda, a reporter at the Illinois Answers Project. Sydney, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Brandis.
So what is the origin for these crime-free ordinances?
Yeah, essentially crime-free housing laws were intended originally to be a tool for police departments to empower landlords to get out problem tenants, people who are committing violent or felony offenses. They originated in Arizona and made their way to Illinois in the early 2000s. But what we found in our investigation is that there are thousands of cases where the original intent and the actual execution of the ordinances, there's a disparate there.
So to the point of what you found, more than 2,000 cases across 25 municipalities in Illinois between 2019 and 2024. What kind of offenses did those cases involve?
Yeah, and like I mentioned, some of those cases were felony offenses. They were drug charges. They were violent offenses. But we found 1,300 cases that were for misdemeanor. Some things as small as shoplifting, calling 911 for help, child endangerment, or forgetting to allowing your child to leave the home. So small cases like that we found over and over. And also there are a lot of cases where charges were ultimately dismissed and people were not convicted of the crimes they were accused of.
Who were some of the people that you spoke with who were impacted?
Yeah. One woman I spoke with, her name was Catherine Garcia. She lives in West Chicago. She lived in her home for 20 years, rented a townhome with her three sons. She had a son who was experiencing a mental health crisis in the summer of 2023 and had to call 911 dozens of times for help. And ultimately, the West Chicago Police Department determined that because of her calls to 911, she was a nuisance. And they gave her landlord a choice, evict her under the ordinance or be fined $750 a day. And the landlord could not afford that fine, so he had no choice but to evict.
Did you find that some municipalities had a more aggressive enforcement mechanism or were more aggressive about enforcing than other municipalities?
Yeah. I think the thing that's interesting about crime-free housing in Illinois is that there really isn't any statewide oversight, so it allows a lot of subjectivity in the ways that the laws are enforced. Cities like Orland Park, DeKalb, Belleville, they invest a lot more in their programs. They have crime-free housing officers who work round the clock. They have databases and technology to track their cases. And they have a much higher amount of enforcement in their cities.
What's the ripple effect for families who face eviction?
Yeah, like Catherine Garcia, for example, they were lucky. They had a friend who owned a home and allowed them to live there for a time before they could ultimately purchase the home from them. But they lived on the floor of the kitchen on mattresses for a month. I've talked to families who are still to this day living in homeless shelters because they could not find housing. It is very disruptive to the lives of families to have to immediately move into a place. Most people don't have enough money to pay the down payment for a new apartment or get storage within the 10 days that they have under the ordinances.
I imagine this is certainly more impacting of those low-income families, like you said, those who were one eviction away from living in a homeless shelter. But also, did you find a disproportionate impact on Black families, families of color?
Yeah, that is something that advocates have studied over time. We didn't do that specifically in our analysis, but I think that something that is interesting is advocates have described that these laws create sort of a two-tier justice system where people who can afford to purchase their homes aren't subjugated to these laws or aren't subjected to these laws. But people who rent, who do typically tend to be people of color or people who make less money, there's another layer of the criminal justice system for them.
What's been the response of the municipalities that embrace these ordinances?
Yeah, cities, I mean, really do believe in these ordinances. Actually, in fact, today there was a vote in the state Senate to pass a bill that could possibly restrict these laws in committee. And even in the hearing today, the municipalities came with strong opposition to the bill because they believe that these are tools to get problem tenants out of their neighborhoods. They point to drastic reductions in calls to 911 as signs of success, but critics say that, you know, we want people to call 911 when they're in need of help. So it really is a conversation that is still ongoing.
And the other thing that's interesting is this applies to both public and private housing.
Correct. Yeah. A lot of times people assume that it only applies to government-owned housing, but this applies in cities to all types of housing. If you go on Craigslist and rent a single-family home from a private landlord, it applies to you. I met a woman who lived out in Richardson Park, lived in a very nice single-family home with her two children. There was a shooting down her block. She called 911 for help a couple of times, and the city decided that she had made an unreasonably high amount of calls to police and ended up being evicted. That city did ultimately amend their ordinance because she sued them later.
There were 30 other municipalities, though, that did not respond to your FOIA request or denied it entirely. Does that potentially indicate that there are even more than the 2,000 cases that discovered?
Yes, there are certainly more cases out there. We asked for a lot of records from a lot of different cities. Some cities just don't track their enforcement, so they had no way of telling us whether of how many people got these letters or got eviction notices. And other cities just did not respond to our requests.
The other thing I found interesting was that under these laws, police officers have the right to order a landlord to evict a tenant, which sounds strange. And what happens to the landlords if they don't?
Right. So a lot of times what the cities do is they use a rental license as a bargaining chip. So landlords are required to register their properties with the city. And if they don't follow the ordinance, they could lose their rental license. So they're essentially losing their entire business, putting them in a rock and a hard place. They really have to follow the ordinance, even if they want to keep a tenant.
Additionally, one of the lawyers that you spoke with in the story says that legislation won't solve all of the problems around crime-free housing. 45 seconds left. What else do advocates say is necessary?
Yeah, I mean, some advocates say that these laws are not good at all and they should be banned in their entirety. California banned the laws last year, and they're looking to do something similar in Illinois. But ultimately, advocates are hoping for due process for tenants, an opportunity to appeal their case, which many cities don't have a mechanism to do that.
Before just being immediately evicted.
Right.
Okay. Sydney King Pineda, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Brandon.
Of course. Up next, a local author discusses her latest children's book. Whether it's asking for a promotion or confronting the school bully, writer Lovie Ajayi-Jones has become an expert on overcoming fears and speaking up. Her books urge everyone to become what she calls a troublemaker or someone who pushes for positive change. She's guiding adults, teens, and lately, even little kids. Her latest children's book, Little Troublemaker, defends her name, encourages kids to stand up for themselves and their unique names. And joining us is the book's author, Lovie Ajayi-Jones, and I, too, share a unique name.
Yes.
So we're in the same club. Welcome back.
It is good to be in this good club.
It is good to see you. Okay, so before we talk about our names, what does it mean to be a troublemaker?
Oh, my gosh. I think to be a troublemaker in this world is to be somebody who wants to be a part of positive change, especially in an unjust world. If you're somebody who is challenging what's going on, you want to be a part of seeing it change. So that's what it means to be a troublemaker, to be the one who is the truth teller and the action taker.
Because sometimes people don't want to hear it. So you're making a little bit of trouble for them.
Yeah, but it's necessary. You know, like the late, great John Lewis said, we should be ready to make necessary good trouble. I think that's required of all of us.
Why do you think it's important that children learn to become a little troublemaker? Because I think we also teach kids something completely different. Don't get in trouble. Stay out of trouble.
Yeah, I think the biggest troublemakers are the little ones. Because at that age, they're young, they don't have any filter, and honestly, they're pure. And oftentimes, we will abuse the pure out of them, insult it out of them, or punish it out of them. And I think we actually need to encourage them to use their voice fiercely. Now, they can use it thoughtfully, right? Making trouble does not mean, you know, creating chaos. But you can do it thoughtfully. And I want the kids to know you can do it now, because we never got that message to do it now.
Right. The book looks at how to respond when people mispronounce your name, which never happens to me or you, especially when your name comes from, you know, a unique cultural background, right? Talk about, you know, what that can be like and sort of navigating being different and having a name that not everybody knows how to say.
Yeah, so many of us know what it's like to walk into the Six Flags souvenir shop and never see our names at all. And with that also comes the first day of school when your teacher mispronounces your name or they look down the roll and they go, ooh, this is hard. And we kind of carry those scars even if it's in the back of our mind. But I think it's really important for us to honor names, not just ours, but other people. So in Little Troublemaker Defends Her Name, my goal is to make sure kids recognize that you can actually insist on people pronouncing your name well, thoughtfully, you can stand up for it, and your name is always worth defending.
How do you, what's your advice on politely correcting someone? Because you do it frequently.
I have to do it frequently, right? That Ajayi always gets people confused. I always say, hey, that's actually not how you pronounce it. It's Ajayi. So you can actually stop people and say, you know what, it's okay. You did not get it right, but here's how you do it right.
Right, because it falls on us, right? And then we're uncomfortable as we're making them uncomfortable, but really it is okay to make that correction.
Give people a chance to get it right. If we never assume, if we always assume that they're going to get it wrong, then they actually will always get it wrong. So let's give them a chance to get it right and say, you know what, here's a fix.
Books also include several Nigerian references, such as jollof rice. Nigerian yourself, how does your identity influence your work?
Oh my gosh, my identity is everything about my work because it influences how I even write. It influences the way I create this character. Like this character is this black girl with a fade who has a strong name, and that was important because I was that girl. You know, in coming to the U.S. when I was 9 years old, it was the first time I was ever othered. It was the first time I felt too different, and that's because I was Nigerian. So this girl's Nigerian identity is part of her. She has a little patch on her backpack with the Nigerian flag. And I've heard from teachers go, a kid went, I've never seen a book with jollof rice in it. And even that is an affirmation.
We also, you know, we don't frequently see a book, like you said, you know, it's a cute little girl, lovey, she's got the fade, and we've got, you know, the illustrations in the book. Tell me about the importance of, you know, of the representation and getting the illustrations right.
Yeah, I want kids to see her and say, she looks like me. Or she reminds me of my cousin. Or, oh my gosh, I also can have a short haircut and still be confident and funny and humble and feel loved. That's the thing about Little Lovey is I also build joy into the way we illustrate this book. It is in the fabric of the way I wrote this book. I want her to always walk away feeling loved. So when kids close the pages, they go, oh wow, she made a mistake, she grew from it, and she ended up having an amazing day.
This is your second children's book.
Yeah.
Little Troublemaker Makes a Mess is right here. It came out in 2023. What made you want to get into writing children's books?
Children need to be spoken to. They need to see representation. They need to feel seen. They need to feel heard. And that's actually my goal with this book series, is that I want kids to always move from the book feeling like they got a good time, they got a good lesson, and feeling good about even when they make mistakes. Because I think sometimes we define ourselves too much by the oops that we make. So the thing about Little Lovey, she will always make a mistake, but she will always learn and grow.
The book, as we mentioned, they both follow Little Lovey and her adventures. Are any of these like specific to your own childhood? Did you happen to make a mess in the kitchen, for example?
Oh, for sure. Because I was overconfident. My problem was I thought I could do everything. So it's she also starts to learn, here are your boundaries. I understand your confidence, but you also need my help as an adult. So it's teaching ways for us to model, you know, you can be confident, but here's where you can learn more.
Can't let you go without, you know, getting a sort of your impression of the times we are living in and how you're using your voice. And, you know, as a black woman, I think a lot of folks, especially in this political season, are wondering, are black women taking a back seat now? Are they sitting down? Are they being quiet? Where are you on that?
We are not being quiet, but our fight is not always physical. I don't think we're necessarily the ones protesting. We need to be organizing with each other, creating mutual aid networks. We need to be doing other type of work. I think people are so used to black women putting things on our back, on our shoulders, and our physicality. I think the fight of this moment for us is about us being in deeper community with each other and the people that we love, and also preparing ourselves for if we have to take on more responsibility because people are losing their jobs, people can't pay their rent or their mortgage. So I think black women's job right now is, one, to take care of ourselves and then take care of each other.
What's next for you? More children's books? More go on?
Definitely. There's more Little Troublemaker coming. There's more books coming, and I'm teaching people how to write their own books through my book academy. So my whole job is to make sure that the words that need to get out, get out.
Okay. Love you, Ajayi Jones. It's a pleasure to have you in here. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Of course. Again, the book is called Little Troublemaker Defends Her Name, something we know a little something about. Up next, a local teen transforms her high school bathroom into a hair salon. But first, a look at the weather. Most black people know all too well the costs of having their hair done. But a North Lawndale student and budding hairstylist is cutting those costs by styling her classmates' hair, all from the girls' restroom. Now, that small act of kindness is turning her into a viral social media star and also a budding entrepreneur. 17-year-old Jessica Thurman spends time between classes spraying, curling, and combing her classmates' hair to perfection. The North Lawndale College Prep Junior posts her work on social media, taking pride in helping those who can't afford a professional stylist.
It feels good because it showed them that they can trust me and come to me with their hair.
Thurman says she's been styling hair since she was 8 years old, but she became a main event when one of her TikTok videos went viral, taking her pop-up salon from the girls' restroom into the spotlight.
I started when a girl asked me to do her hair. It was just random, and I told her I could do it. Because she had a wig, but it wasn't done good. So I told her I could take it home, fix it up, wash it, and then bring it back to her, and then install it in school. She loved it. She went to class, everybody was like, ooh, her hair looked cute and perfect. And she was like, yeah, Jessica did it.
Now, Thurman books about 10 appointments a month, and it's been the right style for her school community.
Jessica's act of kindness allowed for another young lady to smile, because now she doesn't have to worry about the bullying or the, like, can I wear a hood, can I wear a hat? She's alleviated some of those issues in my building. I would be crazy not to thank her.
Thurman is saving up to go to cosmetology school and hopes to open her own salon in the future.
Our hair in this community is our crown. The curling irons, the flat irons, the curlers, the hairspray, it's very expensive. And so one of the things that she was just more so concerned is like, I really want tools.
Her family has even started a GoFundMe to help her chase her dreams and continue a family legacy rooted in hair.
My mom, she started her own little hair business. She went to hair school. She was doing hair in the family. When Jessica was like 3 years old, she used to bring her into the room and have her do her hair. So Jessica loved doing her hair. She would let her practice on doing different styles to her hair. Her dad also cuts hair. And in his family, his dad was also a barber. So like styling hair and cutting hair runs deep.
Giving her community a confidence boost, one hairstyle at a time.
It still looks just as good as the people who's charging the arm and the leg for these styles. So that's why I know it makes a difference, because they love to come to her. They know they're going to get good work.
And building a safe space for a quick bathroom makeover. No beauty school dropout there. Jessica Thurman's family has raised over $3,000 so far on their GoFundMe website with a goal of $10,000. And that is our show for this Wednesday night. Be sure to sign up for our free email newsletter, The Daily Chicagoan, at WTTW.com/newsletter. And join us tomorrow night at 5:30 and 10. Generations of kids grew up with her. we sit down with actress Sonia Manzano to hear about her time playing Maria on Sesame Street. You know, representation in kids programming, and we'll talk about a lot more. Now, for all of us here at Chicago Tonight Black Voices, I'm Brandis Friedman. Thanks so much for watching. Stay healthy and safe, and have a good night.
Closed captioning is made possible by Robert A. Clifford and Clifford Law Offices, a Chicago personal injury and wrongful death firm that serves the needs of clients in the Chicago area and throughout the nation.